an unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Jikoji Sunday program. On this warm day, and our air is a little cleaner, and I hope that's the case for everyone here. What a uncomfortable several weeks we've had. Today, we're honored to have Shishin Ben Myers give our talk. He's been connected here with Jikoji for many years and spent many years studying with Jhana Drekha Roshi, who passed away about 3 years ago. And Jhana was a resident here at Jikoji for a few years, and we value her time here. Ben's lives in the South Bay or Middle Bay, West Bay, and is a crucial part of a sangha, the sangha, Zenkei Sangha, which Jhana Drekha started in memory of Zenkei Blanche Hartman, her teacher. And it's a group based in San Francisco that does work with many disadvantaged peoples up there and around. So we're very grateful, Ben, that you're willing to give our talk today. And so welcome.
Thank you. So I wrote down all this stuff because I'm terrible at remembering things, and actually I'm terrible at almost everything I know of, but I'm perfect for that. Anyway, I wanted to start up by saying that I wanted to honor and remember Reverend Jhana Drekha Roshi and thank my teacher Doug Jacobson. So I am not equipped to dictate, but I love to question. So after this, I invite comments that we can all discuss. So this started because a few weeks ago, Jikoji was reading and discussing Pema Chodron's book, Becoming Bodhisattvas, and I made an offhanded comment that the book was beginning to feel very religious. And of course, Buddhism is arguably a religious practice, but I feel ultimately it's spiritual by nature. So what sparked the comment for me was that the text was being referred to by section such as 5-4, which I associate with Christianity, specifically in the Bible when it says statements like, in the book of Job, page 19, verse 13, it says, ... I don't even know if that's really a reference, but if it is, I apologize. So instead of that, I do feel I like to read fictional stories. So knowing that it would be whatever telling I read will be different from everyone else's. For example. Once a Japanese army was engaged in a sham battle, and some of the officers found it necessary to make their headquarters in Gasan, who was a teacher, his temple. Gasan told the cook, "Let the officers have only the same simple fare we eat." This made the general of the men angry, as he was used to very deferential treatment. And he came to Gasan and said, "Who do you think we are? We're soldiers sacrificing our lives for our country. Why don't you treat us accordingly?" Gasan answered sternly, "Who do you think we are? We are soldiers of humanity, of all sentient beings. There are over 100,000 million interpretations of and in the world. At least one for every different person. We all interpret each word in a major religion's holy text differently. So we create a new religion each moment. When the Psalms or stories or morals or what have you of each religion are quoted as evidence, they can just as easily be understood by somebody else as the opposite meaning. Many will say that there are only less than a dozen major religions, such as Islam, or Judaism, or Christianity, or Buddhism, and of course, or Hinduism. Each person creates their own religion out of their major source religion. To say one way is superior to another, or as in the previous story, when Gasan says that to the general that his monks are practicing a proper way, is missing the point entirely, that each and every religion is different from every other one and should be recognized as such. This is all to say that delusions are inexhaustible. It is easy, as some religions have done, to differentiate between black and white, heaven and hell, good and bad, as can be seen in this story. "I want to know about heaven and hell," said a samurai visiting a monk. "Hakuin, do they really exist?" the soldier asked. Hakuin looked at the soldier and asked, "Who are you?" "I am a samurai," said the soldier. "Ha! You, a samurai! You're so brutish, stupid, and foolish that you cannot understand my insightful comments. Go away and do not waste my time anymore with your questions, Hakuin said, waving his hand to drive away the samurai. This enraged the samurai, and he couldn't take Hakuin's comments. He drew his sword, ready to kill, when Hakuin calmly retorted, "This is hell." The soldier was taken aback. His face softened, and his posture softened as well, and he sheathed his sword. The Hakuin responded, and so opened the gate to heaven. Welcome to heaven. Because we constantly hear in our society that we should choose between good and bad that lead to heaven or hell, I find myself personally losing sight of that at least in this reality, heaven is not true heaven without hell to compare it to, and hell is not true hell without heaven to compare it to. If all you know is the pain in the fires of hell, what is to stop that from becoming enjoyable? If you are experiencing heaven by laying on fluffy clouds, how do you know that it is enjoyable? Here on earth, we cannot lie in bed all the time without experiencing bed sores eventually. So maybe in heaven, we would start experiencing cloud sores, and maybe those are lightning bolts. So anyway, maybe we should not be looking towards our heaven or hell, but making our current existence more enjoyable for us. Addressing the current circumstances, we don't always appreciate how nice it is to breathe clean air without the contrast of all the fires that are raging in the West Coast, which affect all the numberless beings. I wanted to tell one last story. It's an offhanded little tale, like my earlier comment, and I feel it emphasizes ineffability, or the emptiness of how we experience and what we quote unquote know. An emperor asked an old Zen master what happens to us in heaven after death to the enlightened man. The master replied, "I do not know." "But you're a Zen master," exclaimed the shocked emperor. "Not a dead one," said the old master. Thank you, and may peace and long life and health be your experience. And I'm done.
Thank you, Ben. I want to appreciate that we are warriors of humility. That's something to really spend some time thinking about. It's one thing to feel humble, but to be a warrior about it is a whole nother thing. So really, thank you for your wonderful talk.
Chris.
Hi, Ben. Thank you so much for your talk. Where I am right now, it's very, very smoky today and very red in the sky. And when I went out this morning, my first thought was about, you know, how hard it is for me to breathe. And then I thought about what I'm breathing. What I'm breathing is thousands upon thousands of trees burning. What I'm breathing is countless animals that are suffering and dying. What I'm breathing is people's homes and dreams going up in smoke. What I'm breathing is people that have died in this. And like so many things, that perspective, that's what I got out of what you were talking about today. That's the perspective that we as Buddhists should have. And realize that we're all here together, and we have to support one another. And there is no separation from others, the suffering of others and ourselves. We have to expand our consciousness to encompass it all and take it all in. Thank you so much, Ben. I really enjoyed your talk. It was very meaningful to me. Thank you.
Aubrey has a comment.
Hi. Thank you so much for your talk. And I was curious what you think about the more religious aspects of Buddhism versus the aspects that you might think of more philosophically and spiritually.
Do you have any particular religious pieces in mind? I grew up without religion, so I don't know too much. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I don't either, so.
Great. Yay. All right, we can all do things together. I don't feel that there are a lot of super religious parts of Buddhism. I do see that there's And by religious, I guess it's not super like confrontational. It doesn't feel like there's huge institutions that say, this is the way. Do this and be saved. Which I feel like happens a lot with other institutions, other religions. Yeah, I don't know. Nothing springs to mind. Does anybody have any observations that they'd like to share?
Amen. I have a small observation about just the last question that you said, but first I want to thank you for your, I don't know what word to use, very wonderful, wondrous, penetrating Dharma talk. You have such a wonderful sense of humor and such a wonderful, insightful, different way of looking at things. I've seen it multiple times. I think we all have seen it multiple times. So I just want to say, you're such a inspiration. I don't have your vast mind to look at things in multiple ways. So I will just, or in an offbeat way, the way you look at things, but penetrating. I just want to say one thing, couple of things, one about Buddhism and religion. I don't feel it's completely true that Buddhism doesn't do some of the same things that other religions don't do. Like my original religion is now, which is known for in the West for violence and good and bad, but it's not the only one, because Buddhists in East Asia also are massacring, Buddhist monks are massacring Muslims. So no human is, I feel like no human is beyond this, I don't know what to, fanaticism. So, which is induced by, conceptualizing and concretizing religion. But I would say, just a small aspect of, I was just responding to your last thing and as an example, but your Dharma talk was very vast and beautiful. I bow to it. And I just want to give a tribute to what you said from the only way I know, from my own culture, from Iran's Hafez, which said about this topic, which he said, Hafez, forgive the warring between the 72 nations because they did not see the truth. They took the path of myth. So there is a place. So anyway, I won't comment on that anymore, but I just want to thank you again.
Thanks, Ben, for your talk, and I always enjoy your presence when I've been at Jokoji. I guess your story kind of maybe set off a memory that I had a long time ago. I think I was probably in my mid-20s somewhere on an Amtrak train. I'd been sitting for a couple years, and I think I can't remember where I was traveling to from, but I think a memory of, I was coming back from a Shishin, maybe down in LA or something like that. And I was on the train and there was this young Zen monk, all dressed up, you know, to the teeth with those robes and stuff. And somehow I started talking to him. And I think he really picked up on my American enthusiasm for Zen and what it was going to do for me. And the question he had for me is, well, why don't you get what you're looking for from the religion you grew up with? And that was it, you know. But and it was a good question. And you know, it's kind of like, what am I after? What am I? But it's a story that has stayed with me over the years. And you know, there in this Amtrak train traveling somewhere, and and I knew nothing about his. I'm sure he was a Zen monk. He had one of. He had a rock suit on and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know, but it just made me think about religions and what do they do? And they do a lot of different things. And even Christianity, I've known Christians that have pursued that religion much different than the one I grew up with. So things are much bigger than usually our little pictures of different religion. And I think this country in the mainstream has a real narrow vision of Islam right now. And hopefully that gets bigger and other religions too. So, yeah. So thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. The more I look at religions, maybe I have an imperfect in fact, I'm sure I have an imperfect understanding of all religions. But the more I look at them, the more I go like, wait, this is exactly the same as this other one here. What's going on? Where's the beef? Why are we getting so upset at each other? And so I try to step back and look and see, all right, it's not the religions, it's the religions. Like, it's not the institutions per se, like the 12 major religions. It's everybody's individual religion, and just like what we see as an individual, how we interpret the religion. So for that man on the train, that monk on the train, like, you are practicing the religion that you grew up with. You're just tweaking.
Good one.
Can I ask the question?
It looks like Susan Tovar.
Oh, okay, next. Sorry.
Thank you so much for opening up this topic with such caring and understanding of the breadth of it. It evoked a number of thoughts for me about culture and human need. So when you were telling the stories, I felt they were enrobed in the culture of the time. And then we expand them to our universal understandings. So I think each culture and each era, that's really what I was seeing with, you know, the samurai era, the male warrior class. It starts with the human longing for unification and connection. then it gets codified into these religious institutions, then it can be very dangerous. Because power and greed and so forth, you know, those things start to come into play. But each religion, I think, is answering our need for the three treasures and our need to be guiding each other. So just in a brief personal look, I caught the ZCLA precepts a couple days ago. I spent some time with that, and I realized how close we are to the Jewish high holidays, in which we take 10 days to really dig on through that. And it is the precepts, and it is the 10 commandments and so forth. So each of those codifications gives us the opportunity for that empowering individual insight. So we're not dependent on the religious doctrines as much. We are really needing to step forward into our own understandings. And that's, I think, what you provided us today. So I appreciate that we're in a culture at this time, it appears, that we can open up a whole bunch of old packages and look at them without racism, without some of the issues that have plagued our planet. And hopefully we are on the brink of some new understandings. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you. And I will so remember that word, codification. Because I love words.
Taishin has a question from here.
I hope you can hear me, Ben. Thank you so much. Wonderful talk. And I really appreciate your courage in tackling this question, because often I'm somewhat perplexed at doing joint religious ceremonies, considering that in our, you know, in Buddhism, we have, anapan, the idea of not having a permanent soul, a permanent entity, or anything that continues on, is very different. And I was reading a book recently called The Saving Paradise. And it was a book about how in early Christianity, the focus was on the love aspect of Christianity, on treating each other as you would have others treat you, kind of the golden rule. And only later, historically, did the cross become a symbol. And it became about a very, very different emphasis and paradigm on obeying laws and on enforcing laws. And so I'm wondering if perhaps this is another one of those cases where we look at things in an absolute sense, all religions are similar, but in a relative sense, there's great differences that can have very great kinds of results, especially as Susan said, when religion becomes entwined with government. I've seen that myself in countries where if you question something that the government is doing, if the government and the religions are the same, it's very easy for them to then consider it to be a religious attack. And of course, it's a whole nother becomes less about policy and more about obeying. And so I just want to say again, thank you very much for bringing this up and having the courage to let us talk about it.
Yeah, I really think what Kaveh said earlier about how no religion is immune from hatred and warfare towards other religions. Like, there were all the famous Christian crusades, and now, of course, there's like Buddhism versus Islam, and it's the East is not being super understanding of all the other people. And that's, I guess, I feel that that relates to when we become too, when we hold too tightly to those views. And I think, like, a lot of religions say, like, hold them loosely, but especially in Buddhism, it says, or there's an emphasis on holding things loosely. And yeah, I think that we just tend to, like, when we're falling, maybe this is a perfect example. When we're falling, we cling on very tightly to the ledge, but maybe we just need to release the ledge a little bit and just let the ledge, like, give us friction and not so much like the friction of clinging, but just the friction it is wants to give us.
Ben, I liked something that you said about 100,000 million. And I liked the way you tied together the 100,000 million versions of truth to the 100,000 million delusions. And I think that's so exciting, because when we think about it, we are all in delusion all the time. And it's such a wonderful thing to think of them as being different ways of trying to perceive the thusness of our lives. And each one is a delusion, and each one is the truth.
I really, when I was writing this, the talk, I really wanted to emphasize some Buddhist sort of tendencies that I've observed. Like, I split it into three sections with three different stories, and I tried to say, like, beings are numberless, I vowed to save them, or at least claim beings are numberless, and claiming like delusions are inexhaustible. And I'm glad you picked up on the 100,000 million, because I was like, 100,000 million kalpas. That's also, I mean, it just seems like it's everywhere. So I wanted to, and when I said things like, oh, it's 7 billion factorial or factorial, my dad was like, no, no, you need to be careful about using words like factorial. My father is a mathematician and a linguist. So anyway, but yes, thank you for observing that, Kathy.
I think I'm unmuted now. Thank you for your talk. The whole topic is infinite, many different ways to approach it. A couple of things come to mind from Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is that he described our practice as a religion before religion. And I think his primary point in that was to say that we welcome all religions, and that what we do as a practice, you know, the sitting and the sessions, sun services, and so on. But it is religion too, all the services and all the roles and rituals. So it's religion before religion, and we hope we're accommodating all the other religions fairly. And as far as what, you know, the differences between religions, I think, are more or less in the behavior and the attitudes and the competition. And I'm not trying to preach, but thinking that the other thing that he said that might be useful in this context is that at some point it's good to have a general housekeeping of your mind, where you take everything out one by one, look at it, and decide whether you want to take it back, where you want to put it, and so on. I think that relates to beliefs and attitudes and avocations. Those are the primary things that come from his particular book. The other thing that comes strongly to mind is the really muddying the waters, the differences in our country between the Democrats and Republicans. You might say the Democrat and somewhat consideration of other people, and the Republicans, which are mostly competitive and capitalist oriented. It's those two that are clashing together in particular personalities that may say something about all the possibilities for conflict and resolution and the dangers involved in all this. So I apologize for muddying the waters. If you can clarify them, please do.
I'll try, but I don't know if I can. I mean, it seems to me like with the Democrats and Republicans, just to use that one, one cannot exist without the other. I guess sort of you can, but like the Republicans, so personally, just so you know where I'm coming from, I'm a Democrat. Or, no, I'm not. I'm actually a Green Party. I'm not even sure of that. Libertarian, maybe? Anyway, but like the Republicans, like being individualistic, if you will, to put a really broad stroke on it. To be individualistic, you have to be like that exist in it. It sort of exists with others. You need to have others there to be individualistic. So, like, you know, I cannot be individualistic for all if I don't have the rest of you with me, because, like, who's to say I'm not just being a normal person? I don't know, I guess I'm sort of reaching. But yeah.
Ben, I love when you say I can't be an individual without, and I'm reading into this, a contrast between me and everyone else. And I think that's something else that came through in your talk, your Dharma talk, of the idea that there are many points of view. And if we can just not tolerate, but appreciate other points of view, I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. Be aware of them. Go ahead, Kave.
I just, very quickly, I wanted to comment religion before religion. Just quickly say a story from Suzuki Roshi, his behavior, that maybe exemplifies that teaching. One time he was in San Francisco Zen Center. There was a service, you know, like we have a Dharma talk. Son Nakagawa, Son, I forget his last name, but the Rinzai Zen Master Son Roshi was there in San Francisco Zen Center. And they both went to the altar. And Son Roshi sees this book on the altar. And he picks it up and throws it on the ground. He says, "What is this? This is not Zen. What is this? This doesn't belong here." Suzuki Roshi bends down, picks up the book, and says, "Oh, no, no, no. There's a misunderstanding here. This book was given to us by a widow of a man who followed a different religion. We accept everything here. We eat everything here. Come and let's go have some tea." And he touched Swan on the back and they went and had some tea. And the story goes that they were friends the rest of their lives together. I think Suzuki Roshi died before Swan. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that. But stuff like that, that makes me feel welcome in Zen. That makes everybody feel welcome in Zen.
I was just listening to a story the other night on where it was one famous teacher passing on to a student. He's like, "Here, I have this book. It's been passed on from generation to generation." And the student takes it and he throws it in the fire. And the master's like, "Oh my God. Oh my God, what are you doing? That's really sacred." And the student's like, "Oh my God, what are you saying? It's, everything is sacred. Our lives are sacred." So I just enjoyed that, like, idea of, you know, what we should cherish cannot be contained in a book. And a book should not be what we cherish, but we should respect them, but you know, they're not the beginning of it and end. I can recreate a book right now. I'm typing. Does anybody have a couple million monkeys? Chris?
Hey, Ben. Yeah, 100,000 million monkeys might do it. The conversation reminded me of, you know, I grew up Catholic and went to parochial school for 8 years. And I know I'm dating myself, but back in those days, they read everything in Latin. And so it was very mysterious and very kind of awe-inspiring. And so I thought, well, these people must really know what they're talking about. But then they translated it all into English. And then I realized that this is just a bunch of gibberish. You know? At least as far as I was concerned, maybe not to some people, but to me, it said, this doesn't apply to my life. This doesn't hold any deep truths in my life. So then I went exploring into many other things, like and some of them New Age things, and a lot of those teachers had scandals surrounding them, and you know, it turns out that even though they taught love, they were doing really kind of selfish and wonderful things behind the scenes. So then I found Buddhism, and then which kind of had you find your own truth, your own Buddha truth. And in so doing, I realized, you know, if I'm gonna be terribly honest, that I'm kind of full of it too. So I guess we're all in that same boat. So so what do you do, you know? And my only answer is that I kind of have to go into a heart place about it. If I really kind of focus on what's coming from my heart, then I kind of trust that more, but that doesn't mean it's foolproof. My truth isn't any better than anybody else's truth. And as somebody else said, I think it's important to listen to everybody's truth, not believe everybody's truth because we're all deluded, but it's important to give everybody a hearing and then follow your own heart. Thank you.
Something you said, it was when they were speaking in Latin, it was awe-inspiring. What I always think of whenever I hear that is awe.
Well, Ben, I have one final comment here. You pointed out that when we're attached, we want to be able to let go, and we want to deal with the friction of it. And I never thought of that before, that there might actually be friction between what we're attached to and us. And there are many, many different kinds of friction. I mean, mechanically, there are many, many, there are like 20 different kinds of friction. But is our attachment sticky? Is it like Velcro when we have to release our notions that it makes a lot of noise? Or anyway, it's just an interesting notion to have about that there is friction involved in our attachments. And maybe that's a point of contact. That's when you have friction, it's a point of contact between us and our attachments. So maybe that's a place to examine. I'm looking forward to that. So thank you. Is there one last question from anyone? Well, okay. So we'll just make some announcements right now. We just finished a nice calligraphy workshop. We had a few participants here that we were able to accommodate with social distancing and face masks. So that's probably why you see a few more people here in the Zendo. And then we had several, we had, I think, 7 or 8 Zoom participants too. And it was really delightful. Jiro led us in this really nice workshop where we learned to write, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. So when we hold it again, we do it once or twice a year. I hope you can join us either here or on Zoom. We also have coming up the Dankwai Sesshin beginning the 28th of this month, a Monday. I think the next day or two is a full moon, so we'll do the full moon ceremony as well as part of our Sesshin. And we're including the Cleveland Crooked River Sangha is going to join us, and Owan Sangha from Central Pennsylvania with Mado Anderson will join us too. So if you're able to join us for any or all of it, please do via Zoom. And we are going to Zoom it. So thank you. Jikoji offers our programs freely, and we hope that, and we appreciate the help we get in so many different ways from all of you, in financially, in your participation, in the continuity of your practice with us. All those things are so important for our continuing, so please keep doing that. And I think that's all we have at the moment. So let's do the closing gatha. May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it. So thank you, everyone. Oh, also, on Thursday evening, we have book study, and we're studying Everyday Zen. And Michael Schnee is leading that discussion. I think we have 3 more sessions to go, and please join us. We're on chapter 5, and it's a vital discussion. So thank you, everyone. At 6 p.m., 6:30 p.m., I think, is when we start on Thursday evening.
We're on chapter 6, Doug.
Oh, 6? Okay.
Chapter 6.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So... thank you, everyone, for joining us today. If any of you would like to have practice discussion or Dokusan with anyone here, please drop a line to Nico or info@Jikoji, and we'll set that up. And yes, please have a great day and be safe. Thank you.
Okay.
So we're going to sign off. And yes, take care.